Hello, everyone, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show planned for you all today. Laura Rendick will be my guest. She is the founder of Resilient Agriculture and author of Resilient Agriculture, Cultivating Food Systems for a Changing Climate. And she'll be coming on in just a little bit. But first, I want to share with you some things going on in the news and some ways that you can get involved. I want to also thank everybody that came out this past weekend to the Long Island CSA Fair, which was a great success. It was our first event of the year, both Slow Food, North Shore, and NOFA New York, as well as my company, IE Green, hosted the event. And we had about 17 farmers that came out to show people their CSA programs and explain what made their CSA program different than other programs. And as I've talked to people before, CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture, and it is one of the best ways to supply yourself with fresh, organic, seasonally grown vegetables all season long. And not all CSAs necessarily are certified organic, but the majority of them, almost all of them that I know of, follow sustainable growing methods, which means that they're using organic seeds, they're not putting any pesticides or fertilizers into the soil, they're using compost, many are using no-till methods, but they are using good methods to grow the vegetables. And by supporting a CSA, you're actually supporting the farmer and your local economy. You are helping them pay up front for the vegetables that they can buy the amendments and the seeds and anything that they need for their farm at the beginning of the season and get going. And then every week for the rest of the season, you get a box full of fresh vegetables. And every CSA runs differently. Some you have to go to the farm to pick it up. Some have drop-off points. Some have add-on products like eggs, fish, flowers, grass-fed meat, bread. So you need to really shop around. So this is why having a CSA fair was so great. We had some live music. We had a vegan food truck there. And we also had a knife sharpening truck. So people were able to bring their knives after all this cooking that they've done for over the past year. We needed our knives sharpened. So having the knife sharpening truck there was a real joy as well. But I have to say, what really made it special was just being together and being in community. We have all missed it. It's been a long year. And you know, that actually leads me to my next topic that I wrote about this year, this week, was about getting the vaccine. I actually got my first vaccine on Tuesday. And I was really conflicted as to whether to do it or not. You know, it is a new vaccine. It has not been around long enough to be able to really be tested for a long time. I am not a person that is against vaccines, but at the same time, I don't agree that all the vaccines that children are given are necessary. And I do think that they're over-vaccinated. And I do believe that certain children have had really negative outcomes from vaccines. That's why there's the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, you know, to settle suits that people have who have had negative reactions to vaccines. But all that being said, I still decided to get the vaccine. And you could think it's a cop-out, but the reason was I just want things to go back to normal. I want to hang out with my friends. I want to hang out with my family. And most of my family wanted me to get it and would feel much more comfortable to be with me if I was vaccinated. And so that's why I did it. So I got my first one on Tuesday, and I'll have another one at the beginning of April. And then 10 days later, they say I will be not necessarily immune from getting it, but immune from getting really sick from it. So anyway, you know, this question of the vaccine is really something that I know many people are struggling with, whether to just sign up or not. And everyone has to make their own decisions. And that's really the most important thing for me, is that our power to make our own decisions is not taken away from us. I don't like the idea of things being mandated and being forced on us. And, you know, and yet I feel like, you know, that's the direction we're heading in. So do make your own choice. Follow, you know, your beliefs. And like I said, I chose to do it just because I want to be able to be with everyone, and I want everyone to feel more comfortable with me. My weekly take action is to ask you all to demand that our food system is added to the climate agenda. I read that at the United Nations upcoming climate conference, which is called COP26, which stands for Conference of Parties. It's the United Nations Climate Conference, will be taking place in Glasgow. And right now, our food system is not on the agenda. And agriculture and our food system is responsible for 1/3 of global greenhouse gas emissions. And we really need to address our food system. We need to address how we grow it, what we choose to eat, how much animal protein we consume, how much food we waste. There's a lot of really big issues around food and agriculture. And I'm sure I'll be talking more about that with my guest in just a little bit. But I have on here a link for you to tweet the government and to send a petition to make sure that food is added to the climate agenda. And this is National Nutrition Month. Who would have known? It seems like every month it's something. Well, this is National Nutrition Month, and I just shared with everybody on my newsletter a nice article from the Coalition for Healthy School Food. They do great work, and as someone who was really working to bring fresh vegetables into the school lunch program as the food coordinator for Glen Cove Public Schools, I know how much improvement is needed in the school lunch program. And the school lunch program is responsible for feeding so many of our children. For many children, they come home to an empty refrigerator, and their school breakfast and lunch is the only food they get. So it's really essential that this food is good. And I know I sent my kids to a school where, you know, it's a relatively affluent area, and people were really not that involved in making sure that the school lunch program was healthy. They just sent healthy lunch or junky lunch with their children to school and really didn't get involved. And that's a real disservice. We need to all get involved, whether your children eat the school lunch program or not, because so many children really depend on it. So please do what you can to bring healthy school food into a reality. And we also, as you know, we have to get the power of lobbying out of politics, because when I was working in the school district and Michelle Obama was really pushing for her healthy school lunch program and her Let's Move program, the pushback from the frozen French fry lobby companies and the frozen pizza companies — who would have thought that there's lobbyists just for frozen pizza and frozen French fries, but there are, and they have more power than the people. And that's just crazy. So we really need to let our voices be heard. It's just so, so important. And now I want to share with you my weekly recipe. For those of you who celebrate Passover is coming up next week. And so I want to share with you my vegetarian miso matzo ball soup. I have both regular matzo balls and vegan matzo balls. So I'm going to share both of them with you. I am vegan. I've been vegan for over a year, even though I've been vegetarian for over 40 years. And the vegan matzo balls, honestly, they're not as good, but they're pretty good. And they really will satisfy that craving for the matzo balls. So the regular matzo ball recipe is this: 4 eggs, 2 teaspoons salt, 1/2 teaspoon pepper. And I use white pepper just so I don't see little black dots in my matzo balls. 1/4 teaspoon nutmeg, 4 tablespoons coconut oil, 1 cup of matzo meal, and 4 tablespoons of ice water. And you're going to beat the eggs together with the salt, pepper, and nutmeg in one bowl. And then you're going to add the coconut oil. And you want to make sure that the coconut oil is already soft. And you want the eggs to be room temperature, because if you add the coconut oil into cold eggs, the coconut oil becomes hard again. And you really want the coconut oil to be at room temperature so it blends in with the eggs. And You're going to mix that up, and the coconut oil very often will still break into little pieces if it is cold. And then you're going to add the matzo ball meal. I'm sorry, the matzo meal gradually. Then you're going to add the water 1 tablespoon at a time until it reaches the right consistency. And the consistency is, like a cookie dough. So it's not too wet, but it does have some moisture in it. And you're going to refrigerate them overnight if you can, or at least for a couple hours. And then you're going to form them into balls and carefully drop them into salted boiling water. And they're going to cook for 20 minutes on a slow boil. You can cover them, and you're going to remove them. First, remove one matzo ball and taste it. And you want to cut it. And the color should be the same all the way through. If the center is still dark, it's not cooked enough. You want to let it cook a little bit more. So they all should come out the same color, and they should be very light and airy. And then for the miso soup, I use 2 onions, 4 parsnips, that are peeled and cut in half, 4 carrots peeled and cut in half, 2 turnips washed, 2 sprigs each of parsley, sage, rosemary, thyme, and dill, 12 cups of water, 5 cloves of garlic, 1 2- to 3-inch piece of ginger, 2 to 3 additional carrots that I'll add at the end, because first when I'm making the broth, the carrots will get very soft, and those are not the carrots that I'm going to use actually in the soup. I will add some cut carrots at the end so that they still have a little bite to them. 6 tablespoons of white or red miso, and you can actually use a combination if you'd like, and then 1/4 cup of chopped Italian parsley. So in a large pot, you're going to add the 12 cups of water, add the onions, parsnips, carrots, turnips, the sprigs of thyme, rosemary, sage, and dill, and bring that to a boil and lower the heat. Let that simmer for about 2 hours so that you get a really strong, beautiful vegetable broth. You'll have about 8 cups remaining after you strain that. Then you can add the additional carrots that you're going to cut into small pieces back into the soup, and let those cook until they're soft. Remove 1 cup of the broth, and in a separate bowl, you're going to dilute that with the 6 tablespoons of miso and mix that up, and then you're going to add that back into the soup. The reason you do that is you don't want the miso to actually boil. If you want the medicinal value of miso, which is so good for you and for your health, you want to not let that boil. So you can let it get hot, but just don't let it boil. And then add the matzo balls into the miso soup. And that's it. You can garnish it with the chopped parsley and serve. And now I want to share with you the vegan matzo ball recipes, which are a little bit, they're not challenging to make. They're very simple. But I do use aquafaba, which is the juice of the can of liquid from chickpeas. And they beat up kind of like egg whites, and they're really great. So you're going to have 1 cup of matzo meal, 1/2 cake of silken tofu, 3 tablespoons of coconut oil, again, that are softened, 3/4 teaspoon of salt, 1/2 teaspoon of baking powder, 1/4 teaspoon of white pepper, 1/4 teaspoon of nutmeg, 1 tablespoon of minced carrots and 1 tablespoon of minced onions, 2 tablespoons of potato starch, and 2 tablespoons of bison flour. Bison flour is chickpea flour. The juice of 1 can of chickpeas and 4 tablespoons of ice water. So in a food processor, you're going to puree the tofu. In another bowl, using a immersion mixer or a little whisk, you're going to mix up the aquafaba until they turn white and double in volume, kind of like egg whites. And it looks just like egg whites. It's amazing. You're going to then add the softened coconut oil, salt, pepper, nutmeg, baking powder, and pureed tofu to the egg whites and mix that all up. In another bowl, combine the matzo meal, potato starch, and bison flour. Add the minced carrots and onions to that. And then you're going to add the dry ingredients into the wet ingredients and mix that all together. Again, you're going to cover it with plastic wrap and refrigerate it overnight. Then you're going to form it into balls and carefully drop it into the boiling salted water. Cover it with a lid and let it cook for about 10 minutes. And again, you're going to remove it with a slotted spoon, 1 matzo ball at a time. And when you're ready to serve it, you just put it into the miso soup. If you have some vegetarians and some vegans, you can separate your miso soup and have it in 2 pots and do it that way. But it's really great. I wish you all a really happy Passover. And now it's my pleasure to introduce my guest to you, Laura Lennick. And I want to just say I made a mistake when I said her business was resilient agriculture. It's cultivating resilience. She has explored agriculture and our food system sustainably for more than 25 years as a researcher, policymaker, educator, activist, and farmer. And she's now founded and she's the principal consultant at Cultivating Resilience, which is an LLC in Asheville, North Carolina. And she works with organizations of all kinds to integrate climate change solutions and resilience thinking into operations and strategic planning. Laura's work in soil health and sustainable farming systems was nationally recognized in 2001 with a USDA Secretary's Honor Award. Laura served as a lead author on the USDA input to the third National Climate Assessment, and she has led federal, state, and local research and policymaking projects to identify win-win agricultural climate solutions that both reduce greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and also cultivate resilient communities. The second edition of Laura's award-winning 2015 book, Resilient Agriculture, Cultivating Food Systems for a Changing Climate, will be coming out this June. She's a visiting professor in the College of Agriculture, Forestry, and Life Sciences at Clemson University, and a member of the Planetary Health Lab at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. And you can learn more about her work on her website at cultivatingresilience.com. And so, Laura, are you with me?
I'm with you. Thank you. What a great introduction.
Thank you so much for joining me. I know how busy you are, but you were the guest speaker at the NOFA conference this past winter. And that was wonderful. And that's where I first became aware of the work that you do, which is just wonderful. And I just wanted to start, you know, ask you to share a little bit of your personal history. I know that you had been working in academia for many years and recently switched over to the business world. And maybe you can also share with us why you made that change.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. If I think back now on the last 25 years, the way I like to think about it is my path. You know, what has shaped my path and the decisions that I've made at different times. My last job, I worked at a small college. I directed a sustainable agriculture program, taught undergraduate students, did research with them. And I really thought when I started that job 20 years ago, that would be it. That was kind of my dream job. And I would finish out my career after doing pretty significant work in research and policymaking, that I would end life as a comfortable academic, and loved that job. Part of that work involved thinking about the changes ahead for the students I was teaching in agriculture and what I needed to be teaching them, particularly around climate change. And so as we started waking up, I shouldn't say the world, but perhaps as the U.S. started really waking up to climate change, I started to look into it. Really lucky, I think, coincidence was that right around the time I started asking myself that question, what did I need to be teaching students about farming in a changing climate, I was eligible for a sabbatical. And so that's how I ended up working with USDA on the third National Climate Assessment. And that just, what I learned in that year just really blew open my world. I realized—
When was that? I'm sorry, when was that?
That was about 10 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And I really, even though I knew it was out there, I knew we needed to get to work on it and all of that, and I was teaching about it, I really didn't understand that climate change was already happening then. And this was 10 years ago, and that it was already affecting farmers and farming and the food system. And so I learned more about it that year. I integrated it into my curriculum. I got involved in some research projects in my region around food and agriculture and climate. But as I moved through that, I more and more felt like I needed to be doing more than teaching young people. Very important part of the solution, absolutely. But I felt like I needed to be doing more with a broader array of community members. And so 6 years ago, I left the college, started this consulting firm, and I've been working with a really broad array of different kinds of organizations since then, as you mentioned in my introduction, both looking for climate solutions and also just integrating resilience thinking into their operations. And it's a completely unexpected next chapter in my professional career, but it is thoroughly satisfying. And I've learned that I really enjoy working with business and just engaging with business leaders that are ready to act on climate.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you to share an example of a company that you've worked with and how you've seen the change that of your influence and you know, how we can look forward to that?
Yeah, sure. I don't want to name names just because I am a private consultant.
Sure,
but what
sure.
I can tell you is that, for example, I would have to say, you know, when you say tell us about some of the changes, I would have to say that typically I believe that I am approached by companies who are thinking about, they're kind of on the edge, or they're there, they're ready to see what they can do in terms of acting on climate. Another thing I would say about so I've been in this business 6 years now, and another thing I want to say is that, ironically, the previous administration, because of their climate change policies, there was this huge push in business and then at the state level and local and regional levels to begin to work on climate. And so I really saw a change happening there when our national leadership turned away from acting on climate. But I'll give you a specific example then of a business. So I work with small and mid-sized companies, and this was a manufacturing firm based in my region. They knew that they wanted to do something about climate, and they engaged me to create what's called a carbon management plan that involved first estimating their carbon footprint, and then providing them with options for how they could reduce their footprint, and also how whatever part of their footprint they were unable to reduce in their actually reduced within their operations, we looked at different ways, different kinds of offsets that they could purchase so that they could get their carbon footprint to zero. And mm-hmm. this kind of interest, this the name for what they were trying to do in the business world is called a carbon neutral ambition. And it is a movement within the business world at the moment. And that kind of activism within business community really gives me a lot of hope, because they have a lot of ability to, they influence quite a bit the whole climate change equation. And when businesses begin to act, we can really start seeing some differences.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Can you tell us a little bit about your new book that's coming out, Resilient Agriculture, and why it seems like, you know, your other book was just 2015. Why do you feel the need to already come out with a new edition? That much change in just 6 years, huh?
Yes. It's absolutely the world is, from my perspective, when I think about how I frame that first edition, the kinds of actions that I discussed that were happening at the time, it's just a completely different world. It's astounding how different the world is now than when I was writing that book, which it was released in 2015, but I was actually writing it in 2013, 2014. So, But it's the major differences, I would say, with this. So that was the reason we needed to update the book. But also the other reason was very pragmatic. It was almost out of print. So we needed to decide, the publisher and I needed to decide, do we just print another first edition or do we update it? Yeah, or update it. And I jumped at the chance to update it because so much had happened in the world of agriculture climate solutions since I wrote it. So some of the changes, some of the big changes in the book, first of all, I've completely revised it based on what I've learned working in the field for the last 6 years. And so from my perspective, it's much more of a, how would I put it? Kind of a practitioner's perspective on climate solutions and how we engage with them. So it's much more of a practitioner's perspective. Whereas the first time I wrote the book, it was much more a scientist perspective or an academic's perspective. And so it's this new edition. I'm very excited about it because it comes alive in a way that the science perspective, that voice of the dispassionate, slightly removed scientist, that was a great voice and it really actually worked for the times. But I think that this new voice of a practitioner out there actually working in the world is really exciting for the new edition. And the other kinds of changes include, I've interviewed, well, the heart of the book was interviews with 27 award-winning farmers and ranchers all around the country. And I, at the time that I did that work, no one had talked to American farmers about their experiences of changing weather. So that was a really unique, you see it all over now, but back then, no one had asked American farmers and ranchers about that. How they were, whether they were seeing changes in weather and what kinds of changes, and particularly how they were adapting to those changes. Mm-hmm. So that was the heart of the first edition. It's the heart of the second edition. And what I've done is gone back to all those original farmers and asked them, updated their stories, and also added 15 new farmers and ranchers to the mix.
Because so many of my listeners are not farmers. I know this might seem a little rudimentary for you, but could you share with us some of the changes that farmers are seeing? Because I think, a lot of my listeners might not really know what some of those changes are.
Sure, I'd be happy to. All over the country, farmers are reporting too much and not enough water. It's really a paradox. And it absolutely, that idea of having too much water and not enough water at the same time, it is very well aligned with the climate science. What's going on is we've got about the same amount of rainfall happening every year, but it's happening in fewer, heavier downpours. And I'll bet you your listeners, if you start to think about that, we all have noticed this. Rain is coming heavier, and then there are these dry periods in between. So that's what creates that paradox of too much and not enough water. And that is really tricky to manage when you're growing crops, because crops need a steady supply of water, particularly fresh fruits and vegetables. The quality of the fresh fruits and vegetables is strongly dependent on having a continuous high quality water supply. So when your water supply is coming in these enormous rainfalls and then big periods of drought, that's really tough for farmers to deal with. I'll give you one more example. The weather has gotten more variable. Our winters are warmer. The spring and fall weather is a lot more variable. And so, for example, if you're growing a tree fruit, apples, peaches, pears, what's happening more often than it used to is that you're getting a late spring freeze after the fruits have blossomed. And so you lose that whole crop, that the blossoms are frozen. in a late spring freeze or frost. So that's another example of how it's just more complicated. It's riskier and more complicated to grow in more variable weather and with more extremes of drought and rainfall. So that's two examples. The third one I'll just throw out there is that we're also seeing changing ranges of pests, and new pests are showing up. So they're coming farther north, they're arriving earlier, and all of that has got to do with warming winters as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot. It's a lot.
Yeah.
One way that we think about it in adaptation terms when I'm working with farmers is, you know, it's not just one thing. It's what we call stacked effects. You've got this water effect, too much, not enough, on top of the more variable spring and fall effect, on top of new pests and diseases effect. And so it really does begin to stress good farmers, even good farmers, are having to really think about how to adjust to all of these changes.
Yeah.
And then you throw things like what happened this last year on top of that, and which is not weather related necessarily or climate change related, but still, you know, we've got then all of the other normal and very unprecedented sort of market issues and all the other kinds of things that bring risk into agriculture as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I have to say our small farmers were the ones that were able to be resilient in this pandemic. And that was really life-saving for so many people. One other plug I'd like to just say for those listeners that don't know is with this risk for farmers, which is so real, I mean, this is their livelihood. When you buy a CSA, you're also willing to share some of that risk, which is really a beautiful thing. You know, you're willing to say with the farmer, you know, I believe in you. I trust that you're going to do everything you can to supply all of us with the best harvest you can. But at the same time, God forbid something bad happens, we want to help you out. We don't want you to lose your shirt. And so, you know, that's a nice partnership. And, you know, so I just want to put a plug in that for the CSA program as well. Another benefit from it.
Yeah, thank you so much for saying that, because that was the original intent of CSA. It's kind of moved a little bit into more of just a market-based kind of in some places. But I think we really need to lean in more to that idea of sharing risk with your farmers. I think, yes, COVID has absolutely showed us last year that it's the small and mid-sized farmers that were able to pivot so quickly and ensure in the early days of the pandemic, ensure that we still had the fresh fruits and vegetables that we needed. And CSAs, the other thing I wanted to say, you mentioned CSAs at the top of the show, and I think another real power of CSAs besides sharing risk is just creating that relationship with the people that feed you. And so, you know, it's you don't have to wonder what kinds of practices, for example, that they're using. You can ask them.
Right.
And so, you know, that direct relationship with your grower, so valuable. And all the resilience thinking points to those kinds of relationships as what creates resilient community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I also will share, you know, I want everyone to be eating organic vegetables, but they don't have to be certified organic. I just want to say, you know, there's many farmers that choose to not get certification for various reasons. It can be financial. It can be they don't want to plug into the, you know, USDA corporate machine, you know, so for many reasons. But if they're following those practices, and I think farmers are honest, I think you can ask your farmer, like you said, and if they are following those sustainable practices, that's good enough. What you don't want is, you know, a farmer that is trying to greenwash and get in on the CSA program, but they're not following those methods. And I actually don't even know any farmer that doing that. I'm sure I would guess there are some, because it just seems to be dishonest people all over the place. But for the most part, I trust people, and I think you know, all the farmers that I know are growing sustainably or in CSAs anyway.
Yeah. So. Yeah. The other part of that too is that related to trust, that's something that you build over time. And also the fact that you can speak to that farmer directly allows you to use all of the many skills we all have to discern whether or not this is a trustworthy person. So you have that communication, you ask about those practices, you build that relationship over time with the people that are feeding you. And that is, all of that is to the good, to your own right. good, the farmer's good, and to the community's good. So
and the planet.
And the planet, absolutely. and what is so significant in my view about what the CSA relationship is exactly that. You have a relationship with the people feeding you. So you don't need to depend on some USDA certification,
right?
Because the people are in your community, you're engaging with them. And that's really powerful.
And for many CSAs, another plug is that it's not only a relationship you're building with the farmer, but for many CSAs, they have opportunities to come together with community, with the other members of the CSA, so that you're meeting other people in your community that care about the food, that care about the planet. You have potlucks, you have opportunities to come and harvest the garlic, you know, or plant the garlic in the fall, or, you know, help with the strawberry harvest. You know, if you bring your kids to the farm, they're much more likely to want to eat a vegetable that they get to pick than one that you just get at a supermarket. So there's so many positives with it. So, you know, I just love the model. But I want to go back to the work you're doing. I know you're very excited about some of the work you're doing with community-based climate justice work in your Asheville community. Can you talk a little bit about the climate justice initiative that you're involved with?
Sure, be happy to. So this is getting out of the realm of food a little bit, but it's absolutely in the pocket of community resilience, which is my interest, an interest of mine as well. And we in Asheville, we have a new effort being made within our community to really lean into, dig into what climate justice means. And very simply put, what we're doing what climate justice is making sure that all communities within the city have equal access to the tools, knowledge, and information that they need in order to enhance the climate resilience of their neighborhoods. So the Climate Justice Initiative has been working with what are called frontline or marginalized communities, the poorer communities in our neighborhood, in our city, to ask them, what do they think about resilience? How would they like to enhance the resilience of their neighborhoods? And what are the barriers to them enhancing the climate resilience in their neighborhood? And so it's just getting started. It's been going about a year. The first year findings were just released 2 weeks ago. And so we'll be taking those findings in the project I'm doing, which has been funded by the American Society of Adaptation Professionals. And what our job will be is to take those findings from our marginalized communities and work with adaptation leaders in the city to begin to think about how do we address some of the barriers that have been identified by our marginalized communities in order to increase the resilience, not only of those communities, but also of the city as a whole. I think that's one thing that often we forget, that we are only as strong as the weakest part of our community. And so really, one of the things that excites me the most about what I've learned about community resilience, how we cultivate resilience, is that it really is about the whole. We need to be thinking about all parts of our community and making sure that everyone is getting what they need in order to be more resilient and improve their well-being. Because we all, as one goes, we all go. as all go, one goes. So there really is, particularly in resilience, and it's important that we remember that we're only as strong as our weakest link.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's beautiful. And that is so important. You know, something like the Buddha, right? You know, the middle path, or, you know, you can't get to enlightenment unless everybody goes along with you. I mean,
I just want to say that for me, what I think the learning I've done in resilience has really taught me is how true some of these, I think of them as, you know, ageless wisdom, the old indigenous wisdom. How does the planet work? You know, we are all one. And what is so fascinating to me about resilience theory is that it points exactly to these things that our species has known forever, which is that our well-being is tied up in community well-being and tied up in the well-being of the planet. And so what am I trying to say? I'm trying to say that as a scientist, I worked through understanding resilience theory. And very surprisingly to me, where I ended up was kind of a spiritual place that has had a huge impact on the way I approach my work.
Well, I think, you know, in our society, they dissect everything and isolate everything, even the human body. I mean, I remember when my husband broke his thumb and we went to a hand doctor. He goes, oh no, you have to go to a thumb specialist. I mean, not even a hand specialist was enough. You know, I mean, it's just, you know, every part of our body is separate. You know, that you know, to try to find a family doctor that looks at the whole family and looks at the whole body as one is hard to do. And, you know, and one of the things that I've been doing, and I don't have, I don't have a science degree, but helping people connect the dots between our food and our health. And, you know, I was talking about the pharmaceutical companies before, you know, with the vaccines. I mean, I think, you know, we're investing all this money in vaccines and medicines. It's like, what about making people healthy? You know, what about investing money in healthy food? And, you know, we've seen that people who have a healthier constitution are not the ones, for the most part, there's exceptions, most part dying from this pandemic. It's the ones that have the pre-existing conditions. And most of the pre-existing conditions are food-related or chronic diseases that are affected by your diet.
Food and food.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say food and culture. Food and culture related, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there is. And I just want to say there is a movement within public health and the physicians and the medical community around exactly this idea of connecting those dots, as you say. It's called the One Health Movement. The One Health Movement. And it's a subset of physicians and others that work in human and community health. And they absolutely recognize that the health of the planet and our health is inextricably connected. Yeah. And so, you know, for what it's worth, for me, that gives me some hope. There's the medical community has woken up, just like so many other professional communities have, to recognize how much our well-being is connected to the well-being of the planet. So it's called One Health.
I'll look into it and I'll get someone on from there. But yeah, I've had many people on talking about the biome of our soil and the biome of our gut. I mean, who would have connected those before, you know? I mean, it's just wonderful to hear people making those connections, and we need all that bacteria to keep us healthy. And so, it is, you know, exciting? Yes. You know, hopeful. It's hopeful. It gives us hope that enough people are starting to make those connections. And with the new administration, hopefully we can kind of erase these last 4 years and move forward in the right direction. I keep thinking back to, you know, 40 years ago when Jimmy Carter put solar panels on the on the White House. I mean, if we had stayed in that trajectory, where would we be today? You know, it would be a very different place. But we didn't. So,
but we didn't. And one thing I try to remember, because I remember the solar panels on the White House too. But you know, change is cultural. Change is slow. It's slow. And what gives me a lot of hope with what I see happening now is that this message of our health is wrapped up in the health of the planet is bubbling up all over the place in all different communities, different kinds of professions. You know, I it feels to me like we're in a moment where this realization is breaking breaking open, you know, and I think I'm seeing all kinds of connections being made different kinds of communities of practice beginning to come together and saying, oh, look, it's bigger than our little silo, you know, it's right. bigger than our, right. and we really can't address these issues until we talk to others. And that's what makes me so excited about what's happening in food, because many of our most difficult, what are called so-called wicked problems that we're facing in these times come together in the food system in a really unique way.
Yeah.
And we all eat. So we're all involved in the food system. And I'm very excited about the way these solutions are bubbling up, the same solutions bubbling up in all these different communities. We need to basically heal our relationship to the planet mm-hmm. and to each other.
Right.
Community, you know, land, people, community.
Yeah.
Those are the things we're healing. I think this is the work of these times, is to figure out how we do that.
Uh-huh. And I was going to ask you about, you know, in your new edition of Resilient Agriculture, introduces the three rules of resilience. Are those the three rules?
The three rules. Well, I said that the book, I've really rewritten the book because I've had this 6 years of working with these ideas, this practice of resilience thinking. And the three rules are really one of the benefits I've yielded as a result of working with business. And that's because I've begun to understand resilience in a new, more practical way and come up with three rules that if you can follow them, then you are contributing to resilience. And I like to think of these three rules as resilience thinking's superpower. It's the superpower. And really another way to think of it is just, this is the wisdom that resilience thinking, or the body of knowledge that is resilience, really has to teach us. So
okay,
here's the first.
What are they?
What are they? I know, everybody wants to know what. The first is, and this, I'm going to tell you these rules from an individual perspective. Okay. So this would be what an individual could do to try to practice the three rules of resilience.
Right.
The first one, cultivate diverse networks of equitable relationship. You can think of it as equitable relationship. So think about all the different kinds of relationships you have and think about the equity in those relationships. Are they mutually beneficial? And do your best as you can to improve the equity in your relationships. The second is to remember that resilience resides at the regional level. So in all of your relationships, try to, as best you can, cultivate regional self-reliance. Purchase the things you need from your region. When you have waste related to your life, make sure that waste is processed and managed in your region. It's not leaving your region. So that's regional self-reliance. That's the second rule of resilience. The third rule of resilience is in every relationship, cultivate community-based wealth. Accumulate wealth. Do what you can in every relationship to make sure that wealth stays in your community. And I don't mean wealth, I don't mean just money. When I say community-based wealth, I'm referring to all the different resources, all the different assets a community has. So that would be people and land. There's where the land comes in. Social resources, which would be kind of community resources, financial resources, and technological and built resources. So these are the three rules: equitable relationship, regional self-reliance, and community-based wealth. I think that if we all began to practice that as well as we can, as individuals, in the different groups that we're members of, at work, in your community organizations, wherever you operate, wherever you have relationships, you can begin to start cultivating those three rules. That would go a long way right there to improving or enhancing the resilience of our communities.
Yeah. You know, the local shopping one is a real big issue in this past year. I mean, I am so guilty of ordering from Amazon, I have to say. And it's driven me crazy, but at the same time, it's been a blessing. And, you know, I don't really know the answer, you know, because the stores were closed. There was an option. You didn't want to leave your house. You were afraid for your health. And so, you know, I got into this habit. I'm thinking of something that I needed and just going to Amazon and ordering it. And I know it's a bad habit. And I certainly hope as things open up, I can break it.
But the other thing, it's really important to not feel guilty about what we're doing, because we're all in a society as well. And that's the last point I want to make about the rules of resilience and actually individual responsibility. You can only do so much as an individual. And in order for us to really transform our culture into one that is more resilient, there needs to be action taken at that policy level, at that big picture level as well. Yeah. I think, and the other piece, which I didn't say when I think about the three rules, is it part of a resilient community is that you do maintain some connections outside of your region. Those are always there for exactly this kind of situation when you need to draw on other communities because of a catastrophic event like the pandemic. Yeah. I think the biggest concern, because I share your concern and I've done the same thing you've done, you know, yeah. I'm ordering from Amazon. I think that the real concern there is not so much ordering, shopping like that during a catastrophic event, but the real concern is all of the money that left our communities and ended up in one corporate bank account.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
That's the concern. And so it's not so much that a company like Amazon is necessarily a bad thing. It's the bad thing if what happens in that company is they control and keep all that wealth. So you can have companies can be structured such that the regions that they operate in benefit from their operations. That's not how Amazon is set up, but that you could do that. So that's another example of the kind of work I'm doing with businesses, is thinking about how they're structured so that businesses can also follow the three rules of resilience easily as an individual. Yeah.
So maybe you can get into Amazon and help them become resilient and do some of that good work. Yeah. Jeff Bezos, right?
That's right. Yeah. Well, I'd be happy to.
That would be nice. So you recently did some work up in the Hudson Valley. Can you share that with us?
I did, yeah. A really great project. It was in 2018-19. I worked with Scenic Hudson, and they asked me to ask the question, how can land conservation organizations cultivate resilience? So again, taking these three rules and working with Scenic Hudson as an organization to look at what they might be able to do. And we specifically, the charge in the project was to look at how agriculture farms could be supported by conservation, land conservation organizations to enhance their climate resilience. And so the report that came out was called the Climate Resilient Agriculture Initiative. And over 2 years, I worked with a very broad base. It was a community-based project. We asked farmers, we asked food businesses, all sorts of different technical advice and agricultural technicians and researchers and just regular people, eaters. I call regular people eaters if you're not really working in ag in some way. At any rate, we had community meetings that we invited folks in. We also did circles with farmers and with government officials and folks that were working in community resilience, not necessarily agriculture. It was a great project. We really learned a lot. And part of the outcome was to identify some very specific actions that the state and local governments could take in order to help farmers enhance their resilience, and by doing that, enhance the resilience of the local community or the Hudson Valley region as well. Mm-hmm. So very, great. Very exciting project. Yeah.
Great. So we are just about out of time, Laura, but I would like you to share once again your website and how people can reach out to you if they have questions or want to engage your services to become more resilient.
Sure, that'd be great. So I work through an LLC. It's called Cultivating Resilience, and you can find us online at cultivatingresilience.com.
Great. Laura, thank you so much for joining me. It's been such a pleasure. I look forward to having opportunities for our paths to cross again in the future. And everyone out there who's been joining us, thank you for joining us. Work in your own community to become more resilient. And I thank you, and I will see you all again next week. Have a great rest of the week. Bye for now.
Bye.
Yeah.